Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the IGO-INGO Curative Rights Protection Call held on the 28th of September, 2017. On the call today, we have George Kirokas, Petter Reinforth, Phil Corwin, Mason Cole, David Mayer, Osvaldo Nuova, Jay Chapman, Jim Bykoff, and Paul Tattersfield. We have listed apologies from Paul Keating. Joining us here shortly will be Steve Chan and Mary Wong. From staff, we have myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for recording purpose, and to please keep your phones and microphones on mute when not speaking to avoid any background noise. With this, I'd now like to turn it back over to our co-chair, Phil Corwin. Please begin.
Yeah, and thank you, Terry. And by the way, George just asked a question. I was wondering, are either of our staff support on the call right now?
Hi, this is Terry. No, unfortunately, Steve is on another call right now. Sorry, but he'll be joining us here shortly, and as well as Mary. She'll be popping in here in just a moment as well.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, we don't want to proceed without any staff availability. Well, welcome, everyone. Let me start off. Is there anyone who's just on a phone line and not in the Adobe chat room?
Yes, I'm on a phone line. It's Jim Bykoff.
Hey, Jim. Good to hear from you.
Good to be here.
We welcome your participation. And does anybody have a change in their statement of interest? Hearing none. Okay, so a lot of what we're going to do today is kind of be describing the path forward and kind of to set the environment. Some of us at the co-chair level have seen some recent developments. One, there have been, as you know, there was kind of this informal discussion group consisting of council members, GAC members, board members discussing IGO issues, and it's been pretty moribund for the past few months. But recently there was an inquiry from one of the IGOs regarding what was where our working group would be by Abu Dhabi, and the response, which is our plan, is that we now don't expect to have filed our final report by Abu Dhabi, but we do hope and will make every effort to be able to describe all the key elements that will be in a final report for community discussion in Abu Dhabi, and take whatever feedback we get at the meeting, consider that, and then issue the final report shortly after ICANN 60. And the thinking of the co-chairs and discussions with staff, we discussed whether we should have a comment period on the full final report or new elements of the final report. And I think right now we're leaning toward using this discussion time in Abu Dhabi as the means of taking community input, and then not having any kind of formal public comment period after the final report. I would note that that's the general practice of PDP working groups, is to take extensive public comment on an initial report and take that into consideration, but not to put a final report out for comment, but just to forward it to council. So let me stop there. So the things I want to emphasize is that we really need in the next few meetings to get a group. We have agreement on I think every element of a final report other than this one dealing with the rare hypothetical instance of a registrant losing the UDRP, appealing to a court of mutual jurisdiction, and an IGO successfully asserting judicial immunity. That's the remaining substantive item we have to strive to reach consensus on. But we really need to do everything we can to be able to describe all the elements of a final report, including whether we've reached consensus on an approach on that issue for the Abu Dhabi meeting, which it's September 28th, and I'm leaving for Abu Dhabi on October 25th. So we're talking about something that's coming up very quickly. So let me open it to discussion right now whether you know, there's any concerns or suggestions about how we can get to that point. I should add that staff are working on a draft final report, which in many cases will be identical to the initial report. They haven't shared that draft with co-chairs yet. As soon as we get that, and we expect it very soon, we'll share it with working group members, and obviously there's a gap in that report regarding this last issue we've been wrestling with. So I see Petter's hand up. Go ahead, my co-chair. Add your thoughts.
Thanks. And I just, as I saw Petter, I just saw Mary's on die now. So I have a more practical question to Mary. Have we got any more indications on which IGO representatives that may be on our meeting in Abu Dhabi? Because it would be that's frankly the last possibility also to for them to give some input. Thanks.
Hi everyone, this is Mary. Again,
Mary?
Yeah, Mary, we're not hearing you.
Oh. Hello?
We can hear you now.
Okay, great. Sorry. I'm actually in the D.C. office with Terry, and we're using a different phone. So for some reason, the mute button isn't coming on and off on that one. So we don't actually know for a fact which IGOs will be attending our session in Abu Dhabi. From the mailing list, Petter and Phil, I think you're on the IGO Red Cross discussion list. It does sound like it's possible that WIPO and the OECD will be in Abu Dhabi. And as you may have also seen, in relation to a question, I did post this document to that list in the hope that it will draw their attention to it, and also that if they are going to be in Abu Dhabi together with any other IGOs and perhaps even interested government representatives, they will be able to attend our session to provide feedback. But other than that, I don't know for sure which of them plan to be at the session.
Thanks, Mary. Petter here again. Just to add what Phil said, and I think we also discussed that on our meeting last week, that most topics that are not on the and not on the notes and discussions for today. Most other the other topics we have discussed during the years and rather early come to a conclusion on. So that's good. And what we have tried to do here now, also based on all your comments and inputs we have got, and also to wave them into the practical solutions and the main topic for our working group, and with the assistance of the staff, put together this document. We will try to to write down as clear as possible the positives and negatives with each of these three possible solutions. So that's what we are going to discuss further today. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Petter. George, go ahead.
George Krikos, the transcript. I just wanted to point out that ICANN does have a public list of people who have registered for the Abu Dhabi conference, and I posted a link in the chat room so one could check to see whether any of the IGOs that we want input from are attending. Thanks.
Right. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out, George, though I would observe that not everyone registers in advance for the meeting, and you have an option when you register to not disclose your attendance publicly, so that there may be IGOs who are not on that list who may be showing up in Abu Dhabi. We just can't know the full range. The next thing I wanted to bring up the other day on Tuesday, I shared with members of the working group the portion of the board adopted response. The board held a meeting in Montevideo this past weekend and adopted a response to the GAC Johannesburg communique. And I'll read, it's very short, just a few sentences. I'll read the board statement on that. And it goes like this. The board acknowledges the GAC's advice and its concerns. The board reiterates that as part of a PDP, the working group has an obligation to duly consider all inputs received. The board notes that the GNSO Council has informed the board that all public comments and input received by the PDP working group, this is all referencing our working group, including from the GAC and IGOs, have been extensively discussed by the working group. The board notes further that the GNSO Council considers the upcoming ICANN 60 meeting to be an opportunity for further discussions among the community. The board will consider to facilitate these discussions and encourages participation in them by all affected parties. A couple of quick comments on that. One, as we all know, remains a highly politicized issue within the ICANN community, particularly for the GAC and the IGO. I think we have an excellent record that demonstrates that we have duly considered all public comments and input from all parties that brought, relevant arguments and facts to our attention, and we are looking to the ICANN 60 as an opportunity for further discussion on all the elements of what will constitute our final report. So I think our work is consistent with that board response. Let me open it for any discussion of that before I get to teeing up the next item, which is determining who in the working group will be chiming in on consensus. George, go ahead.
George Ricos, again, for the transcript. There was a recent article about Brazil's concerns about .amazon, which led to an article in the Register, and it posted a link in the chat room, and it's kind of interesting to see how politicized the GAC is in terms of saying that they alone have the right to decide what's in the public interest, and that that could obviously be abused. Let me pull up the quote that that is in the article, and I think that's actually not very true because while they have their say, the rule of law is obviously also a public interest, and in some cases we've seen that the GAC is trying to force ICANN to go above and beyond what the law requires, and so it's not our place to be creating new law, especially through this mechanism. If they want to pass a law, they can obviously create a treaty or create laws in the relevant countries, apply it to their own CCTLDs, etc. There's lots of ways for lawmakers to create laws. But it seems that they're saying, we're going to decide what's public interest, and ICANN's board has to obey, and ICANN's GNSO has to obey. And I just don't think that that's correct. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, George. I'd say a couple of things. I would note that the board deferred a decision on the background here on the .amazon application is that it was blocked from consideration in the new TLD program because of objections from the GAC that convinced the board and GDD to put a hold on it. Amazon Corporation filed an IRP and won that IRP that the blocking of that application was not consistent with the rules of the applicant guidebook. Amazon has reapplied for .amazon at the board meeting this past weekend. They deferred a decision on what to do about that reapplication. But the last thing I would say is that the role of the GAC in post-IANA, post-transition ICANN was intensely debated in creating changes to the bylaws to accompany the transition, and it's quite clear that the from those changes that the GAC's role remains the same. It's an advisory role. It advises the board. It's free. GAC members are free to participate in GNSO PDPs, but the GAC does not make policy recommendations. It reacts to the ones that come up through the bottom-up process in the GNSO that are relevant to GTLDs, and it gives advice to the board, which the board is required to actually consider and vote upon only when there's essentially unanimous consensus within the GAC. So it's quite clear the GAC has an advisory role, although some GAC members seem to think it should be greater than that. So I'll stop there. And then the last thing I wanted to mention, which tees up our main discussion item today, well, there's really two items that are interrelated. One is how we're going to determine which members of this working group are going to participate in the consensus determination process, and what options are going to be put before all active members for their consideration. I don't think I'm saying anything that's a secret. In various public forums, Brian Beckham of WIPO has raised concerns about this working group, which I think indicate that there may be criticism of this working group on process rather than the substance of our final report. And he raised that again, in fact, with Mary directly in the chat room. Coincidentally, that was the Montevideo session last Friday in which the board discussed how it would treat Johannesburg GAC advice, and Brian raised concerns about our working group's consistency with sections 3.1 and 3.2 of the GNSO working group guidelines. Section 3.1 says that working group members are supposed to be active participants. Section 3.2 says, and I'll quote, "Ideally, a working group should mirror the diversity and representativeness of the community by having representatives from most, if not all, stakeholder groups and or constituencies, so and that there should not be overrepresentation to the point of capture." So let me say on the first point, and we very much want to avoid process criticism that tries to defer substantive consideration or a final report on untrue allegations that were in violation or acting inconsistently with these operating procedures. We're going to undertake very aggressively in the next week outreach to the 28 members of this working group listed as members. The co-chairs went through that list with staff. In addition to the two co-chairs, nine of those 28 members have been reasonably active, but there are others who we need to determine whether they've really been following our discussions, even if they haven't been on calls and feel that they can make an informed judgment on final consensus calls. So we're going to do that, and we anticipate there may be some culling of that list before we issue a call for consensus. So far as diversity and representativeness of the community, we've reviewed the affiliations of the both the active and the inactive members of the working group. Among the active members, the only place where we're missing participation from the GNSO community, we don't have registrar participation, but we do have good representation from other sectors of the GNSO. I think the IGOs and the GAC would be ill-advised to criticize their lack of participation, since that was a voluntary decision on their part. And even though IGOs collectively determined not to join our list as members, some are observers. They certainly know everything we've been up to, and we've provided several opportunities for them for IGO representatives to share their views with the working group. So I think we'll withstand any process criticisms, but that leads into the first order of business on the agenda, which is that we sent a message out the other day that is staff did to and item one of that message was requesting that members who have not been able to participate actively or recently respond to our message regarding continuing participation in the working group. So we're undertaking that aggressive outreach effort, and we're going to follow up. Yeah, Mary, I read your note. Why don't you chime in now? Where do we stand on getting responses? We know who's been active in the group, and we don't really need to determine that. Where are we in terms of getting responses from the listed members who have not been particularly active of recent days?
Hi, Phil. This is Terry Agnew from staff. I can actually speak on that. So the emails were sent out earlier this week, and currently we had five respond that, yes, they would like to remain on the list and continue on. We had two requests to be removed from the list, and we're still following up with 15 from the list as we've received no response from them.
Okay, well, good. So there's a very active ongoing process, and I anticipate, and certainly my co-chair can chime in, but by the time we have our next call 1 week from today, we will have a pruned list of active members, and that will be the list of members invited to chime in when we issue consensus calls on the options put before members on this last remaining issue. And by the way, I should also mention, while we're going to, when there is a draft final report, of course, before publishing that and sending that on to the council, the full text of that will be shared with working group members with a reasonable opportunity to suggest editing changes or additions, as well as to, if anyone wants to file a minority report on any aspect of the final report, that opportunity is available as well. So let me stop there. Any comment on the ongoing outreach effort to determine the still active members of this working group? Yes, George.
George Krikos. I'm just curious which two people dropped out, because the list of members on the wiki had 30 members, and then you spoke about 28. So I guess you know which two have dropped off. Thanks.
Okay. I don't know about 30, George. The list that staff shared with the co-chairs recently when we looked into this question listed 28 active members, so the one on the wiki may be a bit outdated. I would say I would rather – I don't know, Petter, what do you think? Should we be saying who's dropped off now, or should we wait till we have a final list next week and we can see who's dropped off collectively? Go ahead.
I think it's better to wait until we have the full list. And I also wanted to add that the mixture of our group, the composition of our group, I think it's more or less fulfilled the claim for the ideal composition, even if we have, as you stated, at least one group that are not represented at all. But I think also when we have these face-to-face meetings during ICANN during the years, there have been other representatives from groups of interest being there to listen to us and come up with questions as well. So that's not what I worried about. But as you said, we have a lot of people that are still registered as normal members of the group and that have not been active since perhaps the first meetings we had. So we need to reach out to them. And hopefully we can get at least some of them back on stage to be to actively supporting or participating in this final process. We have also discussed the possibility to reach out and get new members, but at this stage it's a little bit too late for that. And as you all know, we have been dealing with this topic for several years now. So it's better to, even if that final list of active participants, when we have reached out to each of them, may not be more than four or five more people than we have on this meeting today, it's at least we will have a more safe, small list with active members of our working group, which also makes it possible to have our votes and conclusions. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. And Terry, could you tell me again how many have indicated, without the names, that they want to continue being members of the list? Was that three, did you say, or four?
Hi, Phil. This is Terry. Currently, we received five responses that would like to continue.
Okay. Well, good. So our starting point, our baseline when we directed staff to undertake this effort was that we had 11 clearly active members, including the co-chairs. With what Terry has just updated, we have at least 16. I imagine we'll get a few more who reconfirm the fact that they've been following our discussions and want to be involved in final decisions. So I guess we'll wind up between 18 and 20 in that range for the final membership for decisional purposes, which I think is broad enough to meet the representativeness requirement. I don't believe this group has been captured by any particular segment of the ICANN community, and I'd ask a little patience. Let's just wait for that final list, and next week we will share with the full working group who is still a member of this working group and which members have dropped off, rather than doing something today, which in the middle of this process of making that determination. Yeah, and George, I see your comment, and yes, IGOs did make a strategic choice to not participate as members in this PDP. I know that quite well because one IGO representative told me that to my face about 2 years ago, but I'm not going to get into further details on that. So let's now, did anyone have any further? Peter, did you still have comments?
No, just a quick comment on what Paul said in the chat room. It's a nice, very niche topic, which requires a lot of time, and people are busy, so they have to choose which interest to dedicate their time to. And I think that's something that we have to have in mind now when we reach out. We have a lot of active people at the beginning, but we made some initial conclusions in our work, but then we had long periods when we waited for inputs from legal experts and from GAC, etc. So I certainly hope that some of those at least follow us in some way and are willing to be actively participating again now when we're actually in the final phase of our work. So I'm not totally negative when it comes to the possibility to get some active members back in our group. Thanks.
Yeah, well, neither am I, especially since five to have just reconfirmed. So let us move on, and now we have the options document, and we're going to get into the key question before us today is whether this document accurately frames the options for this remaining issue that are going to be put before the active members for consensus call, and that's going to be done very soon before Abu Dhabi. But again, I wanted to emphasize, before we get into the discussion of the options, how much we have within this working group, and then a final report on which there seems to be very strong consensus. And that's the second paragraph of this document goes through that. So I just want to go through it again so that we, while we have some divisions on this final issue, we really have very strong consensus on all the other key elements of a draft final report. The first item is that domain registrants should have continued access. If they lose a UDRP panel decision, to appeal, quote-unquote, to a court of mutual jurisdiction where there's statutory law basis for them to do so, and even when the IGO is the complainant. We made a decision, and we stuck to it, that ICANN should not be in the business of telling any domain registrant that you are giving up some aspect of your statutory law rights when you register a domain. If a complaint is brought by a certain type of party, that ICANN is not going to predetermine the validity of a particular IGO's claim to jurisdictional immunity, that that decision properly remains in the courts. So that's, I think, the first element on which we have very strong consensus. The second one is that trademark rights should remain the sole basis for establishing an IGO standing to file a complaint, either UDRP or URS. And that's because, well, number one, that is the current basis for bringing a UDRP or URS. You must show either registered or common law trademark rights. I think Mary has another term for common law, and she can chime in the chat or whatever. But we've heard from the IGOs that they have some other basis for bringing complaint based upon their treaties or charters or the good work they do in the world. But frankly, so far as the goodness of their objectives and work, many other nonprofit organizations that are not IGOs could make similar claims, and we do know that they made similar assertions in the IGO small group discussions with the board and never identified any other clear and fairly broad basis for assertion of rights to as a basis for CRP service purposes. At least one board member in the public talks of that discussion group observed that after 2 years, the IGOs had never been able to bring forward any evidence of a basis for bringing complaints other than trademark rights. So we simply haven't seen anything, and we also know that IGOs, sorry about that, mixing up my acronyms, that establishing trademark rights and names and acronyms is a relatively low-cost and easy process in just about any jurisdiction, and even if they don't register their trademark rights, if they just send a letter to WIPO, they can provide evidence, and that's the next point. We're agreed, and this is a place where we can demonstrate that we took community comment under advisement and changed our initial report in response to it. We have not been inflexible, and we've backed off. Our initial report said that assertion of six-tier protections would establish a basis for standing, and after quite a number of criticisms of that, in our final report, we're saying that an IGO can bring that to the DRP panelists as evidence of unregistered trademark rights if they don't have registered trademark rights. So, and then the final element is that we've observed that IGOs can mitigate any threat to their claimed jurisdictional immunity by filing a DRP through an agent, assignee, or licensee. So those are the elements on which we have, I believe, quite broad support within the working group. If anyone believes we don't, Now's the time to voice that. So what we're really discussing now is what to do and what should happen in a hypothetical situation that so far as we know has never actually occurred, which is that a domain registrant appeals a UDRP decision where the IGO has been the complainant and the IGO decides to assert judicial immunity and successfully convinces the court that its submission to the mutual jurisdiction clause, and again, we're not changing the mutual jurisdiction clause in any way, was simply for procedural purposes, and it said it's maintained the ability to lodge a substantive defense based on immunity in the courtroom. Where we haven't opined on whether or not the court should agree with that because we can't control what a court does. So, George, go ahead.
George Kirkos for the transcript. Yeah, I don't disagree with paragraph number 2 of this document. I think that's a good summary of what we've already come to a consensus about. I did want to go back, though, to paragraph number 1, which I believe had an error. I actually sent an email out to the mailing list before this call with some comments. And, for example, at the end of paragraph 1, it says that there was an error in option number 4. I think they actually meant option number 5 because option number 4 didn't have the error that's attributed to it. But also want to go back a step further with regards to how we're going to look at these three options, A, B, and C, which are equivalent to the options 1, 2, and I guess 7 using the old numbering. Are we going to form a consensus or attempt to form a consensus before the Abu Dhabi draft final report, or are we going to take the input on these three options and then after Abu Dhabi have the consensus call at that point and try to achieve the consensus based on the input?
Yeah, George, number one, thanks for spotting that error in the opening paragraph, and Mary has already noted that you're correct on that. By the way, David thinks you're not speaking loud enough, so if you further speak, just be a little more power to the volume. But, yeah, it is the intent of the chairs. We would like to go to Abu Dhabi. We already know we can go to Abu Dhabi and say that this working group has a strong consensus on these four elements of a final report. Those are the ones I just went through. We would like to, before Abu Dhabi, and there's sufficient time before Abu Dhabi, once we determine the still active members of the working group and once we determine what options are being going to be put forward before members of the working group to test which, if any, have significant consensus support, to be able to report on that in Abu Dhabi. This is the key issue. The key issue for the IGOs and the GAC has always been the IGO's claim. It's not the only one, but it's certainly been a key one, their claim of complete jurisdictional immunity, which Professor Swain did not share the same view. He said it was a lot more nuanced. But if at all possible, and I don't see any time reason we can't get it, find out whether option A, B, and C, and we're going to discuss whether these are accurately put forward and whether there's additional background elements, details that we need to agree upon as part of placing the option before the group, and whether there's any option we missed to get, see if there's consensus, whether option A, we may find, we're going to ask on each one, do you support, do you oppose? And we're going to take note of that. It's not a formal voting process. It's a little looser than that, but we want to see if any of these has pretty strong consensus without substantial dissent, because that's the kind of thing we'd like to bring forward to Abu Dhabi. I don't know if we'll get unanimous consensus support for any of these, but if we get what's called divergence, where there's a 50-50 or close to 50-50 split in the working group, we're really not in a position to say that there's consensus. We want to at least say that there's good consensus but some opposition, or consensus but stronger opposition. But if we get toward that 50-50 point, then we really don't have a basis for saying there's consensus support for this, and it's our intention to be in a position to say on this one remaining question, what happens when the IGO successfully asserts jurisdictional immunity, what's the next step? That's the remaining question before us, and I don't see any reason we can't see if we have a consensus on the answer before we go to Abu Dhabi. So did that answer your question, George?
George Krikos again. Well, my concern is, and I expressed it in the email of earlier today, is that and the email that I was responding to acknowledged that some of the options weren't fully fleshed out, and so by having a consensus call prematurely, we're kind of forming a consensus over something that, you know, we might later decide that the details don't deserve that consensus. And so my concern is, if we're voting over something that's ambiguous, how can that be a meaningful consensus when, you know, the devil's in the details? At some point in the, you know, past that consensus vote, the members might be aghast that, you know, their interpretation of consensus will be used to justify details that they totally disagree with. And so, you know, they'll be accused of trying to, you know, relitigate or that past decision. And so I think it's important to flesh out these details in advance. Otherwise, you know, what does the consensus really mean? And that's particularly with regards to option number C, which is the old option number 7, because we don't have, I think, sufficient details as to how options 3 and 6 are going to be fully the old options 3 and 6 are going to be incorporated into, you know, the option number 2, and also details on how the arbitration would work. And I actually sent an email, linked to a blog post by two gals, OpenSRS, who were very highly critical of some past ICANN policies, which are causing, you know, huge operational problems for registrants because they didn't fully account for all the different scenarios of the that those policies created, and it's been a nightmare for some of their resellers in India, where people aren't able to get various SMS codes, and by strictly following the policy that ICANN requires them to follow, you know, it's causing a huge mess and causing them, you know, to lose their domains or getting deactivated domains. And so it's very important that, you know, we flesh out all the scenarios. Like, we've covered in that past flowchart some of the scenarios that will occur, but it's kind of like, you know, we've left a whole bunch of details out, and that's where my major concerns are. Because conceivably, I could go for option number C if there's no consensus over option A and B, which would be my first and second choices. But, you know, I can't support option number C until I've actually seen what option C means. And I think others might be in the same boat. Thank you.
Yeah, George, let me address your very valid concerns and point out a couple of things. One, we're a PDP group, a policy development process. We make policy recommendations. Our policy recommendations should be sufficiently detailed to guide the further work of an implementation recommendation team, an IRT, because the way the process works is, after we send a final report to the council with fairly detailed policy recommendations, if the council approves that and if the board subsequently approves it, then it still doesn't go into effect. There's then a separate team that gets into all the implementation details. Now, we want to avoid things being unclear or not fully considered, or so general that it gives the IRT too much latitude, and they can in some way substantively change the policy recommendations. But we don't have to do the full work of the IRT. That's for down the road. And every member of this working group who cares about the implementation of a final report is welcome to that implementation team. That's down the road. So we want to be detailed, but we don't have to do the full implementation detail. Second, in terms of timing, today's the 28th of September. We've got three more meetings before members are going to be departing for Abu Dhabi and be in transit, which would be Thursday the 26th. So this is just off the top of my head without consulting staff or co-chairs, but by next week, we will have the firm list of still active members of this working group for who will be able to participate in our consensus call, and we should be well on the way to fleshing out these options, agreeing that these are the three options, what additional details should be addressed in them. We can continue that discussion if necessary on Thursday, October 12th, but we should aim, in my opinion, we should use the Abu Dhabi meeting to basically put some pressure on ourselves and have a preliminary consensus call on the 19th at the latest. I'd rather have it on the 12th, but we can defer to the 19th. So we can go to Abu Dhabi. The co-chairs can go there with some strong feeling about what, if anything, this group will provide consensus support for in terms of the final issue we've been grappling with. Now, we can keep that consensus call open. We can unveil whatever we have consensus for in Abu Dhabi, take community feedback, not just on the general option recommendation, but on the details we provided, and give everyone a chance to think about whether any of those details is wrong or whether we've missed important details that need to be added in, and then come back after Abu Dhabi, considering all that feedback from the meeting and having had further time to refine whatever option has consensus support and add final details and then take a final consensus call post-Abu Dhabi. So let me stop there and see if working group members think that timetable and that process that I've just laid out, and I haven't discussed it yet with Petter, seems like a reasonable approach. But the one thing I want to avoid is going to Abu Dhabi and say we're still wrestling with how to deal with this successful assertion of immunity question, and we can't tell you where we're at. I don't think we have a really good excuse for going there and not having something to report on this.
Yeah, Petter here. I can agree that option C, there are a number of details to further discuss and decide upon when it comes to that option. But I can also see that these three ABC options have three specific different kind of solutions. Option A is more or less doing nothing. Option B is what we have talked about, that some should only be related to domain names registered after a specific date. And what I've said before, what is stated in option B, that whatever we came out with should be reconsidered after some time or after a number of decisions. I think that's something that is normally in the ICANN policy and ICANN way to deal with new regulations. So that part will be also when if we decide upon option C. So it's I see that's three specific main questions that we actually can decide upon which is the best way to proceed. And then we'll see and further discuss on option C if we decide upon that, which I personally hope we will come out to, and see how far we can go into details. And as you remember, we have discussed some recommendations and details related to option C when it comes to the final arbitration and how that with details about the the how many arbitrators and how to choose them, etc., etc. And what I remember, some of these details we also have a majority support for if we choose that option. So I frankly think we can come out, if we decide upon option C, we can come out after, specifically after Abu Dhabi, with also more more detailed recommendations when it comes to that. And then we will see what will be our final recommendation and the need for another working group to deal with the details to implement this arbitration phase. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Petter. All right. So what I'm going to do now, I want to do two things. First, I'm jumping ahead a bit, but I want to do this while I still have these points in mind. And I hope staff would type this in the notes as I add this. In the option C, and we're going to review all of these options in a minute, starting with A. But for option A, the additional details I know we've discussed, and I think we have pretty good agreement if we went with option C, is that in addition to the arbitration being determined under the national law that the appeal was brought under, that the arbitration should similarly follow the relevant civil procedure rules of the same jurisdiction that issued the statutory law, that the panel deciding the arbitration should consist of three experts, one of whom was a retired judge from the relevant national jurisdiction, that I think we need that IGOs should not be an arbitration forum to avoid the appearance of bias. I think some things we need to address are, will ICANN identify at least one global or several regional arbitration forums willing to undertake this type of very rare proceeding, and or whether the parties to this should be able to mutually agree upon an arbitration body following the national law and the civil procedure rules by mutual agreement, and we have to make sure that neither party can unreasonably refuse to do so and thereby effectively block the use of arbitration. So there may be other details I missed, but I just want to get those on the record while I was thinking about them. And having said that, I would now propose that we use the remaining 30 minutes of this call to discuss options A, B, and C with one, are these the three options we're down to, or is there something else that should be put, some other option that should be added to the list and put before the working group for consensus call? Two, is each description accurate, or is there some inaccuracy that needs to be corrected? Three, do we need to add any additional details to any of these options, not up to the implementation details stage, but so that the policy recommendation is sufficiently detailed that an implementation team down the road can essentially rewrite it because we've left too many things either vague or unaddressed. So let me stop there. Does anyone have any objections or comments upon going forward on these options in that matter? Or should we just get to it? Okay, and George checking off. All right, well, not hearing any objections. Let's start with option A. And again, the discussion today, we're not arguing. We're not having a full and frank discussion of whether we favor or disfavor option A. Our discussion right now is each description accurate, and is it sufficiently complete so that down the road, 2 or 3 weeks from now, this description can be put forward to the working group members and say, do you support or oppose this particular option? So let me read option A, and then we'll open the discussion on whether or not it is an accurate and complete description of option, what we've come to call option A. And it's what it says now is where a losing registrant challenges the initial UDRP URS decision by filing suit in the national court. I think we probably want to add the words of mutual jurisdiction just to be consistent through here and not be ambiguous. And the IGO that succeeded in its initial UDRP URS complaint also succeeds in asserting a claim of jurisdictional immunity in that court. The decision rendered against the registrant in the predecessor UDRP or URS shall be vitiated. So the discussion is now open. Is that an accurate description of what we've come to call option A, and are there additional details that should be addressed in this description so that if it is adopted, there'll be no confusion down the road in any implementation effort about what we meant? So the floor is open on option A. And no one has. So, George, I see a check mark that you're agreeing that's an accurate and complete description.
George Krikos here. Sorry, I hit the wrong arrow.
Okay.
Actually, I'm
so you wanted to raise your hand.
Yeah, it's not letting me do it. It seems to be.
Well, George, I'm recognizing you to speak, George, even though you. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think it's the UDRP complainant also succeeds in asserting a defense of jurisdictional immunity. It's not a claim of. I think the language is a little bit off. It's like they're using immunity as a defense to the claim against them. So I'm not sure the language is necessarily precise, but that's the broad option is correct. Not sure about the wording. We might want to go back to the original wording.
Okay. So I had suggested that the words that after in the first line that after national court we insert the words of mutual jurisdiction, and you're suggesting that we strike the word claim and insert the word defense to make this more accurate. Is that correct?
George Krikos again. Whatever it was in the original final report or the draft report, it seems I'm not sure if the language changed since then, but they don't assert a claim. They assert a they bring it up as an argument, a defense against the claim being made by the registrar.
Right. Well, we'll have staff look at that and report back to us. They can look at the original recommendation as it was put in our initial report and make sure that this is. Consistent, you know, it may need to be consistent, or we may have learned things since then that would speak to changing the wording slightly. But I think it's clear that what we're talking about is that the IGO tells the court, you have no power over us, we have jurisdictional immunity, and they somehow convince the court to agree with that assertion. That's what we're talking about here. So we'll get the words right. But that's the essential thought we're capturing. And then basically, if that occurred under option A, the original UDRP decision or URS decision would be stayed indefinitely or vitiated. It would not be enforced. The domain would not be transferred or extinguished or suspended, depending on the action brought. So, any further comments on the language of option A or whether we need to address any additional details related to option A? Okay, well, of course, if someone thinks of something and wants to come back later, we're not closing out discussion of anything here, but moving on to option B. And, you know, Mary suggested for option A that we say succeeds in asserting judicial immunity. That could work, too. I think they all convey the same thought, which is that the court agrees that it has no power over the IGO, and the IGO gets the appeal dismissed out of court on that basis. And George is agreeing with Mary's suggestion, so I think we've taken care of that one. So let's go through option B. In relation to domain names registered before date, and we'd have to, that's a detail we have to decide on what's the date. It would probably be the implementation date for, you know, this recommendation, but we can discuss the right words there. Option A applies. So basically option B, we'd have to package it with option A. They'd be conveyed together if we go for option B, because you have to explain what option A is. So the final wording of option A will be contained on option B if it was adopted. Proceeding, in relation to domain names registered after, and I think that's the same date, whatever date, however we decide to designate that date, option C shall apply for a limited period. So basically option B incorporates both A and B. It basically says grandfather domains get the option A treatment, which would be DRP decision vitiated if there's a successful claim of immunity, jurisdictional immunity, or if it's a non-grandfather domain, then it goes to this arbitration process as fully described in the final form of option C. So option B is going to be longer than this if it's adopted, because it's going to encompass both of the other options. So option C shall apply for a limited period, duration to be determined. So that's another detail. How many months or years is option C going to be tested if we go with this scenario? At the expiration of this limited period, ICANN and the various dispute resolution providers, including any who administered arbitration proceedings under the new option C, will conduct a review to determine if there are any negative consequences as a result of trying out option C in this way. Let me stop there. I've got a couple of comments that go to details here. And then, George, I see your hand up, but let me just get these thoughts out there first. One detail I see is what happens with non-grandfather domains after this limited period, while the impact of option B is being evaluated. What's going to happen? What happens if there's a IGO-brought dispute against a non-grandfather domain, during a newer domain during that period, while this review is going on? What's the treatment is going to be? Second, I think the language, if there are any negative consequences, I think that's a little too narrow. I think, you know, I can imagine people saying, well, what about if there are positive outcomes from that? So I think the wording should be changed to be broader and consider both positive and negative impacts of utilizing the arbitration process, that just looking at the negative is too narrow. So we need to decide on the trigger date for the grandfathering, and we need to decide what happens during this period after the tryout period while option B is being, and we need to address whether the language for the scope of the review is adequate now. My personal view is that it needs to be broader than just looking at negative consequences. So I'll stop and let me see if there was anything. I think that's it for now. George, go ahead.
George Krikos.
Option B was your suggestion,
yeah.
So go right
B
ahead.
Is the old option number four.
Right.
And their comment in this document above the, like on the first page and the top of of this page, that attack option B, and they kind of misrepresent various aspects of option B. And part of that problem is that option B originally said explicitly to use the creation date, not the registration date, because the creation date is very explicit and not open to interpretation, whereas registered doesn't perhaps take into account transfers and so on. So in the first and in the second sentence, it should be creation date, not registration date. And I put a link in the chat room to the discussion of that today, and a link also to the original proposal. And there are various wrong arguments in this document, which I discussed about today in that email. The other point is precision aspect. It says in relation to domain names before the policy and domain names registered after the policy, one of those should be on or before or on or after. That covers, you know, any domain names that are registered explicitly on the date of the policy. So I think the second sentence should be in relation to domain names registered on or after. And then my third comment was in terms of how long to, you know, have the duration to be determined. I originally specified, you know, 5 years or after, you know, 10 disputes. That might be a way to add the precision, and that was in the original email I sent to the topic, although, you know, that's open to discussion, perhaps, as to what other people feel would be an appropriate time to review the policy. And I agree that, you know, one can look at both the positive and the negative aspects in terms of whether the policy should continue or should revert back to option A by that review group. Thanks.
Okay. Just before I let Petter reply, George, I just want to note, I think your suggestion of it's got to be a long period, because we've never seen such a situation arise. We don't know how long it would take. So I think 5 years would be a minimum to expect, where we might be dealing with an illustration of option C being actually utilized. We need to determine it could be a years and or number of arbitrations. It could be whichever comes first or whichever comes last. There's different approaches. That I think, frankly, on the grandfathering of domain names, you know, a domain name, it's clear that under this proposal, a domain name that's registered by a registrant on the grandfather date, held by that registrant continually after that, is grandfathered. But I think we need some discussion about the other possible scenarios, which is domain transferred directly by the registrant to a new registrant, domain allowed to expire and picked up on the drop catch, so no time gap between the expiration and the new registration, and domain that's allowed to expire drops back in the pool of available domains and then is re-registered at some considerable time after that expiration occurs. So I'll stop there and let Petter chime in. But I guess I'm saying option B, we need to fill in quite a bit of details on that before we have something to put before the group for consensus call. Petter. Petter, are you on mute? We're not hearing you. Hello.
Hello. Do you hear me?
Hear you now. Yes, loud and clear.
Thanks. Sorry. I just want to say that when it comes to the review, I think that's something that we should have in whether we decide on option C. And I also think that's more or less a standard for all these kind of specific regulations. Talking about, and we have discussed that before, should it be counted on time or the number of disputes? Well, I saw George's suggestions, 5 years or 10 disputes. I'm not so sure that if we choose 10 disputes, it may be after 15 years. So I think it could be better to have a specific number of years. I presume that there's also some kind of I can stand that for that. Five years, no earlier than that.
but also in order to have some disputes to consider when the policy is reconsidered or so something that counted on years and maybe up to 7 years or something like that. But again, I turned out to if I can start have some information on what's the standard when it comes to this. Thanks.
Okay, and thank you, Peter. George?
George again. I thought we were, you know, trying to create the options that we're actually going to have the consensus call about. Like, I explicitly proposed creation date back when we started, and one of the criticisms of this document by the co-chairs is that there's complexity about whether things are grandfathered properly if there's a change of control. And that criticism is actually created by substituting the words that I never actually proposed. So you kind of can't have it both ways. I actually proposed a very precise option in option number 4. And so I don't consider the language to be like a friendly amendment. It's actually creating the complexity that's then being used to criticize it. So you could create some other option as a non-friendly amendment to option B, but that's not what I actually proposed. And so my option is consistent with past practices of ICANN, which I noted in the emails that I linked to, namely how two-letter.coms are handled for the they're all, you know, reserved and they're all grandfathered by creation date, not the date that they were, the change of control happened or whatever. Same for the recent IGO policy that came into effect regarding reserved names, which I linked to in the email, which I don't have to talk to you again. And that's how also, you know, top-level domains themselves are handled. There's different policies for .com as opposed to new gTLDs. So the creation date was the proper language. Also, with regards to the other point about when the review could take place, I actually explicitly said it should be the earlier of, you know, after 10 disputes or 5 years, although I'm open to it being after 7 years, the earlier of the two is to handle the situation where you suddenly get a flurry of IGOs filing UDRPs, causing, you know, these court actions to take place that then lead to arbitrations or that are perhaps mishandled by the arbitration companies. So if there were 10 arbitrations within, you know, the first year, then the review would take place after 1 year. If there were 10 arbitrations after, you know, 20 years, then the earlier period would be the 5-year cutoff or the 7-year cutoff or whatever people want to decide on. But, you know, I propose it explicitly as 5. So the way option B is currently written, it's not a friendly amendment to what I've actually proposed. So it should go back to...
Well, George, let me stop you a second. I think you'll be pleased with what I'm about to say. I think in regard to these options, option A is kind of a carryover from our initial report, and we just we don't want to change it much. We may have to add some details, but that's something we're carrying forward in our initial report. On the other options, I think while we're not debating right now whether or not they should be adopted by consensus support, I think the proponents, we know who the proponents of these options are, should have somewhat greater say in how they're framed. And you're the proponent of option B, I think formally option 4. So how would you like this to be put before the full working group? I think we can have some feedback from other working group members, and you can decide whether you're proposing something that may lose some support when we have a call for consensus. But I think ultimately the proponent should have a little stronger. Well, on most things we try to have very even consideration of input. I think in terms of framing these options, the strong proponents of a particular option should have somewhat greater say in framing them for the consensus call. So having said that, why don't we go through this right now rather than going to option C and see if in the remaining 11 minutes of this call we can flesh out option B in a way that's satisfactory to you, that think captures – what you want the group to say yes or no to. Is that acceptable?
Sure. I can go through it right now. George Krikos again. Option B, in relation to domain names, change the word registered to created before and then leave date blank. Option A applies.
Point of information. What's the difference between creation and registration? Can you? I'm not sure what you'd mean by that word change. I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I just want to understand what the word means because we're going to be asked.
The creation date is explicit at the registry level. At the registry level, there is a creation date for a domain name. That's the date when it was very first registered. Because various UDRP panels and people talk about registration being different if it was renewed or even transferred. And so creation date is unambiguous. And I think we've got a couple of registry people, Mahar and Cole, who could vote for that. And I'm sure everybody else probably understands that concept as well.
Okay. So let me ask a question and be completely clear on the import of that. And again, it's your proposal, you get the strongest hand in shaping it. So you're saying that if you own Kirikos.com and tomorrow you're kidnapped in a UFO and taken off Earth and you don't get to renew the domain, so it drops back in the pool and at some future date somebody else wants to register that, they're still grandfathered because the date, the original creation date of the domain shall be the date that's considered for grandfathering purpose, regardless of any change of registrant through any fact pattern after the creation date.
No, that's not correct.
Correct on that.
George Krikos here. If the domain name goes through the full deletion cycle and gets deleted, then when it gets registered by somebody else, brand new, it's considered to have a new creation date. So a domain name that gets transferred or that goes through a pseudo-deletion, that goes through NameJet or SnapNames, where the registrar kind of captures that before the RGP takes it into effect and the creation date is unaffected, that would still be considered, a successor in interest of the grandfathering. And so they would still be going through option A in that case. Option C under option B would only take into effect when it's actually has a creation date after the implementation of this policy. So it's totally unambiguous, totally clear.
All right. Well, that explains it. And Mary suggested we had a footnote. I might think it might better be an explanatory paragraph after the first sentence or two after this by what we mean by creation date. But I understand what you're trying to get at. If the domain is transferred one registrant to another, it's still grandfathered. If it's dropped and is just totally deleted from the registry and then is re-registered by someone new down the road, it's not grandfathered.
Right. The Whois has a the Whois has an actual creation date in the Whois, so it's
okay.
And so the second sentence would then change to in relation to domain names, and then instead of the word registered would be created. And then instead of after, it would be on or after. Option C shall apply for a limited period. And then instead of duration to be determined, it should be the lesser of after A, 5 years, or B, 10 arbitrations have occurred. So under option C.
Okay. So you're proposing that the review be conducted
at the earlier.
All right. So and let me just suggest we haven't the date that's in parentheses. Can we agree that that would be the implementation date for the new policy?
Yeah,
I'm not sure. We could use some staff assistance on framing that, but. I think what we're talking about is the date. Are we talking about the date the policy goes into effect, or the date the report is approved by council, or the date it's approved by the board? What date would you propose be the key date here, the grandfathering date? And once you speak to that, I want to let Mary speak to something, and then we'll get back to this. So. On the grandfather date, what is your thinking?
George Griglis here. It should be the date that the policy is approved by the board. So that's when they typically tend to go into effect. Or, you know, the board will approve the date, the policy. Well, the GNSL would approve it, then the board would approve it effective on a certain date, just like the EDRP takes into effect on a certain date, or the EUDRP or the URS. It's whenever the policy goes into effect. So it's not going to be backdated, you know, 20 years. It'll just be effective on a forward-going basis.
Okay. All I would point out there, and I think I'm correct on this, is that there's going to be a time gap between board approval and when the policy really goes into effect. It doesn't go into effect until all the implementation details have been agreed upon. So there's a time gap which creates the possibility of a situation arising where there could be a situation that would should give rise to an arbitration, but where there's no fully approved implementation of the arbitration yet. Hold that thought. I'm going to let Mary chime in, and then we'll get back to B. Mary?
We have two comments, and one is in relation to the date question. Although, Phil, you've already said some of what we thought we should put in for folks to consider, that in terms of putting in a specific date, in other implementations, and as you noted, Phil, these do take time, we will need to consider the possibility of people trying to have a certain set of rules applied to them before it's too late, if I can put it that way. So whatever the correct date is that we want to recommend, from the staff experience, this is a consideration that we should look at more closely. In relation to the timing of a review, and this goes back to something Petter said a while ago, we don't have a specific framework in terms of number of years for particular PDP consensus policies to be reviewed, obviously because that depends a lot on the context, although there is a general movement afoot to have periodic reviews of every consensus policy we have. For this specific question, whether 5 years or not is appropriate, that is something that has been recommended, I believe, in other policy processes. But in relation to the 10 arbitrations, I will say that on the staff side, we have a couple of initial concerns. One is that that may depend on self-reporting by the arbitration provider or providers, and obviously it gets a little more complicated if you have several providers. So there's a slight accuracy concern there. And the second concern is that if indeed we do get, say, 10 arbitration proceedings commenced in, say, a year, that creates an uncertainty in terms of policy implementation dates that generally we try to avoid in consensus policies. And it also creates the possibility that if we have to basically scramble to do a review in 1 year, that there could be practical problems with that as well. So our recommendation, at least initially, is to consider probably a period of years for certainty and other reasons. Thanks, Phil.
Okay. Mary, we've got 2 minutes left here, so I'm going to take a quick comment from Petter, get back to George. I have one question for George, and then we're going to have to wrap up for today and discuss our approach next week. Petter, quick comment.
Reminded correctly, we have discussed this before, and when it comes to how to get information on the cases, and we concluded that the IGOs would be one of the parties that would be interested in giving us feedback on the cases, and also of course the registrars. They need to, as they are the ones that should stop the transfer of the domain name, so they have all the information. So I think it could be rather easy to get that information on how the cases are going. Thanks.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I'd be incredibly shocked if we have 10 successful assertions of judicial immunity one would have 10 registrant appeals followed by successful assertions of immunity within any short time period. But we could easily just require the parties to notify ICANN of the arbitration as a condition of entering into it to make sure we're not missing anything. George, I want to ask you one last question and recognize we're not finishing up on option B. Once the whatever the period is, whether it's 5 years, 10 arbitrations, whatever, once that review commences, what would happen with the non-grandfathered domains during the review period?
George Rico, just to go back to that prior point about the information gathering, that was actually explicitly supposed to be part of option B. There would be information gathering in order to solve exactly the problem that was raised. So that was in the original email, which I linked to. As for the point you just raised, nothing would change with regards to option B until that review was done, and so that review could decide, to cancel and revert everything back to option number A. It might decide to keep everything status quo. It might even conceivably recommend modifying the procedures for option C in order to more balance them. For option A, the grandfathering would continue. So the non-grandfathering group would be the only group that might change depending on how that review went. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, George. We are 1 minute past deadline here, so I'm going to wrap us up and just put forward the way forward in my thinking for our next meeting. First of all, I'd like staff to revise these three. Well, we haven't discussed. Yeah, revise option A with the minor typographical changes we agreed to in that discussion. Revise option B. To reflect the conversation we just had with the understanding that that is not the final language that will come back. We'll start next week's discussion by completing framing out option B in a way that's satisfactory to its proponent and clear to the rest of the working group members, and that addresses any further details that working group members needs to be addressed in option B so they really understand what they're being asked to support or oppose when we get to consensus. And on option C, to list the additional details that I put forward that are in the notes. So we'll come back. We'll start next week. Number one, next week, we'll start by advising the full working group of the results of our outreach and identifying the final membership of this working group for consensus call purposes. Then we'll return and complete the discussion of option B in terms of framing this in a way that we feel it's detailed enough, that it's accurate and detailed for consensus call, and then we'll perform the same with option C, and that would probably be a pretty full agenda for October 5th. I think, which will allow us on October 12th to begin the consensus call discussion, and then on October 19th to take a firm show of support or opposition to each of these options, and to know what we can report in Abu Dhabi. So we can have further discussion of that on the list. George, I'd invite you to interact with staff on option B so that when we come back next week, it's as much to your liking as possible. And unless there's a burning desire by any participant to get a last word in, I think we can wrap the call now. So any final comments here?
Okay. I made one in the chat.
What's that?
Peter, I made one in the chat just that I think we have discuss general principles for binding arbitration. I sent it as a reminder to the list. I think that could be...
Just asked staff to add those details to option C so that they're in the document when we come back to it next week. Yes, George?
This is trying to, George Rico, trying to help people with regards to option number C, which we haven't gotten to today, but there's a concept called court arbitration. That might be something that Phil and Petter might want, or staff might want to research to see whether the court themselves of mutual jurisdiction can order an arbitration or define the arbitration provider for option C. But that's a friendly amendment.
Good suggestion, George. I want to thank all the participants. I think we've made a lot of progress today and are on a glide path to taking consensus call on clearly defined options prior to Abu Dhabi so that we can go to Abu Dhabi and have a good working group session where we can inform the community on the elements, on what the elements of our final report will be, get their feedback, and then be able to come back right after Abu Dhabi and adopt a final report. So thank you all. Have a good week, and see you all next Thursday. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, the meeting has been adjourned. Operator Pence, if you could please stop all recordings. To everyone else, please remember to disconnect all remaining lines and have a wonderful rest of your day.